Blog Talk Radio.
Hermetic Hour, and I'm your host, Pope Runyon. Tonight, we're going to conclude our adventure from 3,500 years ago, the ancient Canaanite myth of Prince Akkad and the magic bow. Now, in the last episode, Prince Akkad, the son of King Daniel of Bashan, had gone up north of the Sea of Galilee to the slopes of the Lebanon Massif, to the mysterious city of the moon god, pursuing his vision of a mysterious moon maid, a princess of the moon sisters, the Kotarat, that he had seen in a vision. He and his two companions reached the Tower of Skulls. Inside, the moon maid climbed the stairs and got all the way up to the top. A cop chased her up the top of the stairs, just as a mighty eagle swooped down, grabbed her, and she was gone, vanished. A cop chased her on the parapet, looking over each side to see if she had fallen. Oh, there was no sign of her anywhere, but then he heard the tinkling of her silver bells from high above. He looked up into the night sky to see a great bird of prey circling the tower with the torn hem of her veil clutched in its talons. His love had been snatched from his grasp by Anath's winged demons. The bitch goddess had killed his dream. At least he would have revenge. Akkad took the coiled rope from his belt and cast a bitter end down through the hole in the loft. "Tie my bow and quiver onto the rope," he shouted to his companions below. Quickly, he hauled the god Kothor's mighty weapon and magic arrows up into his grasp. As he strained to string the bow, the eagle, still clutching its forlorn trophy, perched atop one of the four lofty horns that projected from the corners of the tower. Akkad's gaze was fixed on his prey. He did not see the great flock of hawks swooping down out of the night sky behind him. Suddenly, the birds of prey fell on him, clawing at his face, ripping his flesh with their beaks, forcing him to his knees with their beating wings. With a muffled scream, he dropped the bow and the quiver to fight off the ravening sky demons with his bloody hands. But now the great eagle, ridden by the dark spirit of Yat-Pan, winged down from his perch. The mighty werefalcon seized the harried prince by the shoulders and severed Akkad's jugular vein with three slashes of his razor beak. King Daniel's only son gasped and choked in his own blood as the light of life faded from his eyes and the smoke of his soul went out through his nostrils, and he realized too late how his passions had betrayed him. The murdering man-eagle grasped Akkad's fallen bow and quiver in its talons and winged aloft, making way for a werebird of vastly greater size to descend upon the still bleeding corpse. Shumal, mother of eagles, began her gruesome work with beak and claw, not pausing until she had devoured every scrap of bloody flesh and every splinter of shattered bone. And as the she-eagle pecked up and swallowed down the last pitiful remains of Bashan's slain prince, the night air grew still and heavy, as if heaven held its breath until distant thunder rolled and dark clouds the stars. Down below, Prince Akkad's two companions had finally summoned the courage to climb the narrow staircase. They emerged out of the loft just as the mother of eagles rose from her grisly feast and launched herself into the storm-black sky. The sight of this monster bird and the torn and bloody remnants of the prince's garb were mute testimony to the tragedy that had befallen their lord. With heavy hearts and fearful minds, they descended the 100 steps, down past galleries of grinning skulls that seemed to be laughing at some joke only the dead would find amusing. Well, 10 leagues to the south of Khor Dablim, that other great eagle, with a bow and quiver clutched at its talons, was flying through a gale. Far below him surged the dark waters of the Sea of Kinnereth. The great bird, buffeted by the wind, struggled with all his strength to keep his course, but a blinding flash of lightning and a terrible crack of thunder shocked him senseless. For an instant, his claws released their grip. The bow, along with its magic arrows, fell into blackness, while the clouds rolled westward, carrying the precious rain beyond the parched fields of Bashan. In the royal bedchamber of the palace at Hernam, Queen Danate was tossing in throes of a nightmare. In her dream, she heard her baby son screaming. She hurried to his aid as a flock of black ravens rose from his crib, trailing his glistening pink entrails from their beaks. She voiced a cry of anguish and sat bolt upright, wide awake and terrified. King Daniel, who had been slumbering beside his wife, roused himself on his elbow and shook the sleep from his eyes. "What's the matter?" he mumbled.
"He's dead. My son is dead," Danate said in a hollow voice.
"By what means? By whose hand?"
"The birds, Anath's birds."
And the king's heart sank to hear this, for he knew that his wife had dreamed the omen he feared the most. Their daughter, Pugat, Akkad's older sister, entered her parents' bedchamber with tear-streaked cheeks.
"I heard you cry out, mother. I, too, have had an awful dream in which I saw a vulture eating my poor brother's heart."
At this, the king rose and called for his servants to dress him for a journey. "We must go and search for him at first light."
"It's too late," the queen murmured.
"We must find enough of him to bury," her husband said in a voice that rasped like a wood saw from his throat. King Daniel and his daughter, Princess Pugat, set out at dawn to follow the trail of the prince and his companions. They dressed in humble fashion and rode donkeys, for they knew that once past the borders of Bashan, royal robes and a gilded chariot would be dangerous luxuries. Hernam lay 3 leagues south of the Jordan River's upper mouth, and all along this route, Daniel was shocked to see the desolation that the blazing summer sun had brought to the wheat and barley fields of his peasants. Kinnereth's sea level had dropped nearly a cubit, drying up the springs that watered the hillsides. He managed to find only a few green shoots in the dried mud along the ditches. King Daniel sat down in his ruined fields and he wept. "Our land is dying, and the fault is mine," he told his daughter. "The fault lies with Mote, the Lord of Death. Perhaps this year he has wounded our Rainbringer beyond a quick recovery. We know that this has happened in the past. In your father's time, there were 7 years of drought and famine." "Yes, and it was because my father offended the gods. I've never told you that," he muttered.
"Well, sometimes I think the gods offend us more than we offend them," she said, but not too loudly.
Daniel nodded in silent agreement. "My brave daughter, there is a secret I must confide to you. Then you will understand why this is happening." So saying, he proceeded to explain her brother's divine parentage and the purpose of his sad destiny. Pugat's serene countenance clouded with sadness. And then her delicate features hardened in a fierce resolve. I knew they were using him. I told him as much, but he never listens. Then she corrected herself. Never listened to me. We must find him and bury him properly before this autumn equinox, if our land is ever to recover. And I have a blood price to extract from the one who killed him, she whispered, be it man, woman, god, or goddess. In Yatpan's tent, the warlord was on his knees before his divine mistress, pleading for his life.
I was not born with a bird's claw, my lady, and in my own strong grip, I would have held a bow. The lightning frightened my feathered mouth, and even as it would cause a horse to rear up.
The moth let out her breath in a sharp hiss as she lowered and sheathed her sword. Yatpan was not to blame. A hot, dry wind with lightning and thunder, she muttered. I see my brother's hand in this. And yet he lies in Moat's deepest crypt. Before summer solstice laid him low, Baal must have cast a mighty spell to confound me during his yearly repose. Had it not been for Akats lusting after that succubus, I doubt we could have harmed him. And it was all for nothing. You lost the bow! Yatpan rose on one knee.
But you had your revenge.
The goddess's anger boiled up once again. You mortal fool. They wanted me to kill their little half-godling. I see it all now. I'm to be blamed for the drought and the famine our crime has brought upon the land. The red rage that had driven her for so long finally gave way to a great sadness. Why had her own family conspired against her? Why had her younger brother, Prince Baal, whom she had so often defended and so often rescued, betrayed her? Why had Kofoa crafted a magic bow to kill her winged messengers? Where had they gotten the idea that warfare was evil? Without wars, there would be no conquests, no loot, no slaves taken, no epics sung, no histories written. Warfare was man's path to glory, and woman's path to involuntary servitude, but why should she care about them? She was the fighting man's goddess, not a consoler of wives nursing their brats and chewing their husband's sandal leather. Nor was she a patron deity for giggling girls and wiggling harlots. Anath sat down on a camel saddle in Yatpan's tent, picked up a lyre, and strummed a lament. I killed him for his bow, for his arrows laid him low. But his bow was lost to me when it fell into the sea. Now the hero may not rest until his tomb is blessed. Flesh and bone return to earth in the land that gave him birth, or the sprouting grain will die ere the harvest time is nigh. And on the forest trail between Hazor and Khort Ablim, King Daniel and the princess were met by Prince Akkad's two surviving companions on their way southward to bring the sad news back to Hernan. The two young men fell at the feet of their king, begging his forgiveness for failing to defend their lord. Daniel could plainly see their rent garments and festering wounds they had already inflicted upon themselves. He promised them no further punishment if they would truthfully tell him and the princess exactly what had happened. In halting speech, interspersed with recrimination, they recounted the whole tragic story, including the strange vision of the moon maiden that had led Prince Akkad to the fatal ambush atop the tower. Black sorcery, King Daniel growled. Devoured between earth and sky, no grave below in which to lie, the Lady Pugat whispered. Even his final sacrifice was for naught. I will make a great offering to Prince Baal. He will help us recover Akkad's remains, Daniel said.
He won't hear you, Father. The Cloud Rider lies sleeping in the caves of Moray, a prisoner of the Dark Lord. He will not waken until equinox, if he wakens at all, she reminded him. Then I shall journey to the back of beyond and wake him myself, Daniel declared in a terrible voice that even his brave daughter dared not answer. There was nothing to be gained in entering Court of Bleem, but Daniel insisted that they come in sight of the town. And when such a vantage point had been reached, the king went up on a high place, which overlooked the city of sorrows, and with his arms raised to heaven, he delivered such a curse that to this very day, all these snakes and scorpions inhabit that desolate vale. After pronouncing doom on Court of Bleem, King Daniel sat down on the hilltop and wrapped himself in his cloak. He remained there in deep meditation for the remainder of the day and through the following night. At sunrise, he descended to embrace his daughter and confide his vision. Father El came to me in a dream and told me to journey southward to his shrine on the mount above Salem, and there I will find the entrance to the underworld. We will go together, Pugat said. Only as far as Renam. I must go on to Salem alone, he declared. A week later, King Daniel, alone and on foot, clad in a homespun robe of a shepherd, walked the dusty road westward from ancient Jericho toward the town of Salem. And by late afternoon, he was in sight of that small walled city, which crowned the southernmost of five low hills, and beyond the town, directly to the north, loomed the bare rock crest of Mount Moriah, a site which had been sacred to Father El since time began. The city's gate was open. He passed through without a challenge, and just inside the barbican, there was a magistrate sitting at his table under an awning, checking an Egyptian merchant's bill of lading on a papyrus scroll. And Daniel waited until the official had finished his business before making his request. I am a pilgrim seeking the blessings of El's high priest. Can you direct me to his temple? Oh, you wish an audience with our holy king.
Well, you have no high priest? Well, he is the high priest, the magistrate said. Well, then where can I find him? Atop Mount Holy Mount, 7 days hence. And Daniel had no intention of waiting that long. He took off his golden signet ring and handed it to the official. Send this to your priestly king with the greetings from the ruler of Bashan. The magistrate looked carefully at the royal seal and then handed it back to King Daniel. Our holy king has been expecting you, my lord, he said, bowing his head in respect. He clapped his hands to summon a young boy and whispered instructions in the lad's ear and dispatched him in haste to the palace. A short time later, a burly, white-bearded giant of a man in a snowy robe and a purple mantle, wearing a gold medallion of El's eight-winged, all-seeing eye around his neck, swept into view. He was attended by a Nubian who shaded him with a fringed parasol, and he was followed by a mob of laughing children. Do you have any dates? The holy king asked just the magistrate in a voice as he approached the table. They think I have an inexhaustible supply. A basket was produced from under the table, enabling the monarch to feed his multitude and finally shoo them away. He put the empty basket down and clapped a strong hand on Daniel's shoulder. Daniel of Bashan, welcome to Salem, he said with a friendly smile and a twinkle in his eye. I am Malek Zadik. But, as a brother king, you may call me Shem. The Malek Zadik's palace was spacious but austere, with white plastered walls, massive ceiling beams of cedar, and floors of polished oak. A sweeping wall mural dominated the audience chamber. This panorama depicted the sinking of a great city and the escape of some of its people in ships. King Shem obliged Daniel's curiosity with an explanation. Well, over the centuries, the great flood of legend has come to mean the drowning of the entire world. Now, that's not what happened. In the olden times, the level of the oceans just slowly rose, and many seacoast towns were gradually inundated. But my ancestors believed our city was too sacred to be abandoned, and over the years, we built great earthen dikes and concentric rings that surrounded the palaces and temples. And the sea rose higher and higher, but we raised the ramparts higher yet, until one winter there came an awful storm, with towering waves that breached the earthen walls, and the city was submerged forevermore. Some of my ancestors escaped my ship and reached these shores. How long ago did this take place? Daniel asked. Long ages before the Egyptians raised their pyramids. But I'm a poor host. Your feet are unwashed, and you have had no refreshment. The holy king clapped his hands and then invited his guests to sit. Servants came forth to bathe Daniel's rude, weary feet in hot water. Spiced wine was poured for him, and pomegranates, dates, figs, and cheese were offered. Having provided the amenities, the priest king came directly to the point. Daniel, my friend, you have the look of a man who suffered a great loss. Tell me, what tragedy has befallen you? Briefly, Daniel recounted the story as he knew it, leaving nothing out, including his oath to descend into the underworld and waken the sleeping Prince Baal. At this, King Shem raised his bushy eyebrows in surprise. By Boel's mighty member, that's an oath to make strong men wet their britches. You realize that you probably won't come back alive. That's the least of my fears, Daniel said. I've come to you because it is said that an entrance to the underworld is hidden somewhere on the slopes of your holy Mount Moriah. I seek the key to that secret gate and whatever blessing you can give me. Melchizedek acknowledged gravely, yes, there is an entrance under the great rock that crowns the summit. It's called the Well of Souls. You'll need 10 fathoms of rope and a lamp. And as for my blessing, I could do no better than to give you this, he said, taking the golden 8-winged medallion from around his neck and passing it over to King Daniel. You notice the inscriptions on the back of each wing. Do you read alphabetic script?
No, we use cuneiform. I read Akkadian. Well, no matter.
If you follow these formulas counter-sunwise from the top, you will open each of the 7 gates to the cavern world.
Now, what about the 8th?
Well, you pass through that gate at birth,
King Shem said. Well, dare I ask what these letters mean?
They are permutations of El's secret name.
Well, this is a gift beyond price. How can I ever repay you? Daniel asked.
The priest king of Salem looked upon his guest with eyes that seemed older and wiser than Daniel dared imagine. Gods and goddesses are but human reflections in El's great mirror, he said. When men and women no longer need a goddess of war, I will be repaid. With a coil of rope, lamp, goatskin of water, a knapsack of provisions, and El's medallion around his neck, King Daniel climbed Mount Moriah with the early morning sun at his back. He found the narrow entrance to the Well of Souls hidden in the base of the great flat rock that formed the crest of the sacred mountain. A curious raven circling overhead was the only observer as Daniel belayed his descending line off a tamarisk bush and slithered backwards feet first into the dark opening. The vertical shaft was small enough in diameter to brace his back against, enabling him to chimney crawl his way down 10 fathoms to where the hole opened into the ceiling of a high vaulted gallery. The end of his rope dangled high above a huge mound of debris that had fallen down through the well shaft over millennia. Daniel dropped the last 3 cubits to the trash heap below and scrambled down to the cavern floor. The gloomy chamber was illuminated by the thin shaft of light from above. In the far wall, there was an ancient bronze door, set deep in the natural rock. Flanking this portal on either side were a pair of freestanding pillars, one of marble and the other of an orange metal that resembled brass. Both of these columns were decorated with strange symbols and inscribed with alphabetic characters that were oddly familiar. He held his lamp and examined them more closely. 4 of the glyphs matched those which made up the formulas on the back of El's medallion. Cast into the greenish bronze of the ancient door was a bas-relief of the planetary symbol of Saturn upside down. Below this figure, a golden triangular plate was inset in a recess. This triangle was engraved with the same 4 letters that made up the formulas on the medallion. 3 at the points
and one in the middle. Daniel touched the gold plate and discovered that it was loose in its setting. Each point could be depressed independently, as if balanced from the center. There was no handle or ring to open the door. So, obviously, the triangle was a kind of lock. The king pushed, pulled, pried, and for a moment in frustration, and then he remembered old Shem's instructions. He turned over the medallion and looked for the first formula in a counter-sunrise direction. Aleph, Mem, Sheen, Tau. And sure enough, Aleph, Mem, and Sheen were engraved on the points of the golden triangle with Tau in the center. He pressed the points down in that order and then pushed at the midpoint inward. There was a soft click, and the ancient door swung open. Beyond the door, a steep, narrow, and twisting flight of stone steps led downward as far as his lamp's light would reveal. And from the surrounding darkness came mournful howling sounds and hissing whispers as if all the ghosts of the netherworld were trying to make themselves heard. The sheer sides of the stone staircase fell away into an abyss of utter darkness. Without hesitation, Daniel descended. The door clanged shut behind him, and the rush of air from its closing blew out his lamp. After a moment of total darkness, his eyes adjusted to the deeper level of gloom. Far below him in a vast cavern, he could barely discern a line of torches. A line of torches making the edge of a lower plateau. He went down and down until he reached the level ground at the bottom, and here he could see that the edge dropped off into a bottomless crevasse. There seemed to be nothing but Stygian darkness below. All along the lip of the verge sat huddled human figures, gray with the dust of endless years, softly weeping, sadly moaning, hopelessly waiting. Daniel peered out into the blackness. He knew intuitively that this dark void was not as vast and empty as it seemed to be. There was something solid about it. He picked up a rock and threw it hard. Clang! The next bronze door was less than 4 cubits away. He walked back a few paces, clutched his medallion, took a running start, and leaped straight off the cliff. Daniel landed just over the ledge on the other side of the chasm. He looked back at the forlorn ranks of lost souls still waiting, still prisoners of the illusion. They hadn't even raised their heads. He turned to the door, marked with the inverted symbol of Jupiter, pressed Mem, Sheen, Tau, and Aleph, and again there was a clicking sound, and again the door swung open. He entered a huge cavern, dimly lit by natural phosphorescent glow from the rocks themselves. These surfaces flickered with strange abstract patterns of light and shadow. Directly across the gallery, facing him, crouched a huge statue of a black lion. Beyond its massive forelegs, set deep in its leonine breast, was the third bronze door. Its gleaming gold triangle beckoned Daniel forward. He marched straight toward it, but the great lion's head drew his gaze upward. He stopped and stared up in fascination. The huge head was alive. It was drawing him up and inside. And then he was the black lion. Gigantic, all-knowing, and all-powerful. The imprisoning cavern walls were gone. He, as the black lion, was enthroned on a dais in a vast hall of a marble palace, surrounded by thousands of worshipful subjects, all on their knees, raising their hands in unison, and then prostrating themselves like a rippling wave as they chanted, "Hail to the King of Heaven and Earth!" Oh, it was exhilarating, but Daniel could feel his identity, that sum of faults and virtues, that unique index of memories, hopes, and dreams, fading away, eclipsed by this vision of ultimate power.
Drawing on the last spark of his individual humanity, he clutched the eight-winged medallion of Father El. A soul-wrenching snap on the pebble that was his consciousness was a stone flung from a sling, and he hit the ground before the bronze door, deep set in the black marble of the lion's breast. And upon this portal was displayed the reverse symbol of Mars, and another golden triangle, and Daniel pushed the points of the plate in the order of the next permutation, and the door swung open. This cavern was as hot as the inside of a furnace. Daniel soon discerned the source of the heat, which was also the one and only exit from the third hell. On the other side of the chamber, carved into the rock wall, loomed a gigantic stone face. Its wide open mouth suddenly belched out roaring flames. The ground surrounding the image was strewn with scorched bones and blackened corpses. And as the jet of fire subsided, bronze fangs clashed together in a smoking maw. And when the teeth opened, the searing fire streamed forth again. Daniel studied the awful contrivance with its curiosity, trying to plan a way of jumping through the open jaws when neither fire nor fangs would touch him. After a few minutes' observation, he concluded that it would be impossible. The only alternative to plunging through the fire itself would be to sit down at the far edge of the cavern and wait for the flames to eventually burn out. But when he looked to either side, this option did not seem promising. In the shadows along the walls, huddled rank upon rank of the living dead, loss of hope had dimmed their eyes, and the dust of ages had made them gray as stone while they waited for the fires of hell to subside. With a grim resolve, Daniel waited for the fangs to snap shut, and then he sprinted toward the mouth. "No, no, don't do that! You'll be destroyed," mournful voices wailed. A blazing ball of fire raced to meet him. He clutched El's medallion and plunged into the flames. The firestorm was hot, but not hot enough to stop him. He dived headfirst through the open mouth. An instant before the metal teeth clashed together, Daniel somersaulted to his feet. He lost his lamp, his water bag, and his knapsack, but he still held the medallion in his fist, and he was past the flame. On the next door was just ahead, marked with the sign of the sun below the horizon line. Again, the formula worked, and the door swung open. Daniel found himself in a crystal maze of narrow passages through naturally polished surfaces, and he soon came to a fork in the path between the glistening walls. Which way should he go? Reflected simulacrums of himself, stared back from several different directions. He soon discovered that these images were more than mere reflections. They had minds and opinions of their own. "The only way you'll ever get through is to keep running to your right. Keep turning to your right," one of them told Daniel in a perfect imitation of his own voice. "No, don't listen to him. You have to keep turning left," another image insisted. "No, turn right and then left," a third suggested. "No, turn right twice and left twice," a fourth argued. Daniel held up his medallion. The tip of the first wing, going counterclockwise, curved up to the left. On intuition, he took the left-hand fork and made his way deeper into the maze. At the next dividing point, he took the right-hand path, and so on for another six turns, following the wing points of the talisman until he reached a dead end. The eighth passageway ended in a cul-de-sac. Daniel faced a sheer wall blocking his way. His image on the crystalline surface mocked him. "There's only one way out and 10,000 dead ends," his reflection declared. "Turn around and go back." In what had become an unconscious reflex, Daniel's hand touched the priest king's medallion.
At the gesture, his reflected image changed into that of King Shem, and the Melchizedek spoke. That last reflection of yours was telling you the truth, but in a misleading way. Now think carefully on the literal meaning of what he said. Daniel pondered for a moment, and then he turned around, faced away from the crystal wall, and stepped backward through it as if he had no more than a curtain, unless it had been no more than a curtain of morning mist. He turned to face a gray rock wall into which was set a bronze door emblazoned with the upside-down symbol of Venus and the now familiar golden triangle. The ancient device again yielded to the fifth permutation of El's secret name, and the king of Bashan found himself standing on the edge of a featureless plain over which was strewn an endless litter of desiccated human flesh, bones, and body parts. Giant black ravens circled in the air, shrieking defiantly, or strutted through the carnage, picking at tidbits of gore. As Daniel surveyed this desolation, he felt an awful corruption expanding from his bowels up into his belly. His body swelled up like a dead horse until it finally exploded. The airborne ravens descended on his scattered remains to disperse them further, an eyeball north, an eyeball south, an ear to the east and an ear to the west, with entrails spread around all the points of the compass. But the medallion lay in the exact center point of his dispersion, and his consciousness had remained with it. Mentally, he recited the sixth permutation and the eight-winged talisman, which was itself a form of compass, began to draw his scattered parts together again. And when Daniel was complete, he walked easily across the field of woe until he came to the sixth door, which readily opened to his touch, admitting him into the courtyard of his own familiar palace. His household and all his vassals and his lords greeted him with applause. And wonder of wonders, Prince Akkad was there, alive and smiling, and he held out a golden goblet. Your sacrifice has saved us all, and I'm resurrected. The land is fruitful again. Drink to a new life. Daniel took the cup Akkad offered, but he hesitated to drink from it. He had thus far passed through only five hells, so this must be the sixth. Let the earth drink first, he said, and poured out a libation that withered the grass at his feet. The illusion vanished in an instant, revealing a gray cavern wall and the seventh door. Passing through the portal, Daniel found himself in his own bedchamber. His beloved Queen Danate, her sweet face streaked with tears, rushed into his arms. Oh, Daniel, thank the gods you've won through all the hells and made your way to me. The king's heart was wrenched with a painful yearning that turned into a bitter rage. This too is an illusion. The gods are cruel beyond belief. No, Danate insisted. They are merciful. When I heard that you had vowed to enter the underworld, I knew you would never return. I couldn't bear to live without you, so I took my own life, hoping against hope that we might find each other in the caverns of the dead. He held his magical amulet out to her, and with a soul-deep sadness thickening his voice, he said, kiss the eye of the All-Father and swear that what you say is true. As he feared, the vision of his life's love vanished instantly. He stood ankle-deep in green slime. The seven hells he had passed through were pallid dreams compared to the intensity with which his senses perceived this awful environment. He was in a vast, dank, echoing cavern, lit by smoking torches and flooded with putrid sediment. Flanking him on either side, as escorts, stood two giant yellow-winged creatures, half insect and half human. They spoke to each other in chittering whispers. Before him, in the midst of this subterranean swamp, rose a stone dais, surrounded by torches and surmounted by a funeral pyre. And on the black marble slab, the Lord Cloud Rider, Bal-Hadad, was laid out in his armor, utterly still and bloodlessly pale. Just beyond Baal's tomb, crouching atop a taller platform, loomed the scorpion throne of the Dark Lord Moat. The black-robed and hooded god of death lounged at ease under the curving arch of the huge arachneid's tail. From the stinger above him, bright yellow droplets of venom fell down into a skull cup, which Moat held in his left hand. With the long, bony finger of his right hand, he motioned his locust men to usher the king of Bashan to the foot of his throne. Moat sipped the hell broth and licked his thin lips. "Daniel," he said, "your time is not yet. Why are you here?" Daniel gave a brief account of the adventures that had befallen him and his family, remembering his sorrowful experience in the last and final hell, and he ended his summary with an inquiry after his wife. "Well, at this moment she still lives," the Lord of Darkness informed him. "And you tell an amusing story. I hear so many sad stories. You have no idea how boring they can be." Moat pondered the issue of Daniel's trespass, and then he said, "Well, as you know, I specialize in endings. And if I were to keep you here, this tale of yours would not come to a satisfactory conclusion. Well, may Prince Baal return with me now?" Daniel dared to ask. "No, my brother must remain here until the daylight and darkness are equal. But you may at least speak with him." Now, King Daniel bowed respectfully to the Dark Lord, turned and slogged his way through the muck to the slippery stone steps leading up to Baal's resting place. The mighty Prince of Thunder lay inert and very pale. Daniel was not sure he would respond, but he had to try. "Lord Baal, it is I, your earthly servant Daniel. Do you hear me?" The dormant god's eyes remained closed, but his lips moved ever so slightly as he whispered, "Yes, Daniel. I hear you." Again, the king of Bashan recounted the course of events, concentrating on the details surrounding Akkad's murder. "And we have to find him and bury him before the equinox," he concluded. And Baal said, "Anath swore before the eight-winged throne that she would not kill Akkad. But there was no mention of not eating him. And my sister often assumes the form of Shumal, the mother of eagles. Shumal is the only bird large enough to devour an entire human body with all its bones. And because no god under heaven would aid her in this villainy, I am certain that she employed the services of her henchman, the warlord Yatpan, probably in the form of a lesser eagle to do the actual killing. But perhaps steal the bow," Daniel mused. Very likely. But if he did, he could not hold it for long. I will recover it." "Well, where may I find Shumal, and how may I vanquish her?" Baal says, "She has a nest in a great cedar tree on the slopes of Mount Hermon. To vanquish her, you will need my mace, Yagrish, the chaser. And once you hurl it at an enemy, it cannot be avoided or repelled. Take it with my blessing, Daniel." The king of Bashan held up a magnificently balanced war club with its jagged head of black star metal clutched in a golden dragon's claw. The weapon was alive in his hand, surging with deadly power. But Daniel was not overconfident. Mount Hermon would be a five-day forced march from Salem. And there were only that number of days left before the equinox. "Now, if I can only reach Mount Hermon in time," he muttered. Well, you have just enough time to recover and bury a cut. And only if you stop for nothing, no matter how important it may seem, I'll warn. A raven flew in through the open fly of Yacht Pond's tent and perched on Anoth's shoulder. And as the bird chattered its message into her ear, the war goddess's expression contorted, and she stiffened, and it stiffened into a fierce mask. Daniel has entered the Well of Souls on Mount Moriah, she muttered through clenched teeth. Well, and that's the end of him, Yacht Pond observed. Not while he wears Hell's eight-winged medallion. The gods continue to conspire against me. Could he raise Baal? Could a mere human do that? She shook her head. No, but he could bring back one of Baal's weapons. Sound your war horn. Gather your host for a great battle while I summon the Mother of Eagles. Yatban strode out of his tent, took up his trumpet, and blew a mighty blast that carried to the furthest reaches of the broad valley. From 1,000 black tents, his warrior tribesmen swarmed forth and rushed to the center to stand by their goddess's red skull standard. Anoth mounted to the crest of a pinnacle of rock and blew a shrill whistle. And before the last of Yat Pan's warriors reached their battle formations, Shubal, the Mother of Eagles, circled above Anoth's head. Shubal, Anoth cried out. I command you to fly ever westward, over the sea, toward the setting sun, for 6 days and nights. Upon the seventh day you may return. Now go! The giant sea eagle shrieked acknowledgement. She wheeled to the west and flew away toward the sea coast. Having thus sent the last remains of a cot beyond the reach of King Daniel, Anath surveyed the black-robed and red-veiled ranks of ferocious Sutea tribesmen gathered about her gruesome standard. She put her words into Yat Pan's mouth as he shouted his orders. The whole kingdom of Bashan is ready to fall into our hands like a ripe fig. We march to Hernan for battle and for siege, and a talent of gold to the man who brings me Daniel's queen. King Daniel, wearing the leather armor and headdress of an Egyptian courier, rode his exhausted horse into the remount station at Beth Shan, 2 leagues south of Hernan. It was there that he met the first refugees fleeing from Bashan. Without his kingly beard and with his clean-shaven face framed in the striped tent cloth, no one recognized him. They took him for an Egyptian army officer, and they were thus anxious to report the seriousness of the situation. The Suteans have laid siege to Hernam, the merchant said. I could just cut out in time. Is the city well defended? Yes, but the well outside the walls has been captured, and the cisterns within are almost empty. Hernam can hold out only a few more days. What of the queen? Daniel asked. Yat Pan promises that he will spare the lives of all within Hernam's walls if she delivers herself to him. Otherwise, he vows that every man, woman, and child shall be put to the sword. A wounded Mishanian soldier, leaning on his crutch, added to his comment, "Well, she ought to give herself up. Our king deserted her and all the rest of us. We have no one left to rule the kingdom, so what's the point of fighting?" Daniel tried not to show emotion. This was what Baal had warned him against. He set his jaw and hardened his heart against the urge to make a pointless sacrifice. There was 1 day left before the autumn equinox. He would ride clear of Hernam and press on to Mount Hermon. Shadows lengthened over the towers and battlements of King Daniel's fortified city. In the royal bedchamber of the palace, Queen Danate reclined on a couch. As a serving maid massaged her body with scented oil, another servant laid out her most precious jewelry and her finest gown. Her handmaidens had bathed the queen with damp towels because water was now more precious than gold. Never had she been more beautiful or sadder in her heart. Her daughter Pugat entered
carrying a tray with a goblet. She hurried to Danate's side. Mother, I know what you intend, and I beg you to reconsider. It's too late. I have already sent a messenger to the warlord of the Suteans. He expects me at midnight. Fugat motioned for the servant girls to leave the room. When they were gone, she said, let me go in your place. Danate shook her head. Even if I cared so little for you that I could permit such a sacrifice, it would accomplish nothing. That pawn will be satisfied with no less than the queen. It is more a matter of state than of passion. Yat-Pon boasts that all that he killed my brother while in the shape of a hawk. That is also a matter of state and of passion. Well, your passion is for vengeance, her mother whispered. Like your father, I too have sworn an oath. And then Pagat changed the subject. How will you endure Yat-Pan's touch? Nanate said, I shudder at the thought. Unmixed wine might help, she said, offering the goblet to her that she had brought. And a few moments after drinking the wine, Danate's head began to nod. Her eyelids fluttered shut, and her chin fell upon her breast. By late afternoon of the final day, King Daniel sighted the great cedar tree on the slope of Mount Hermon. It was the tallest in the forest, and the nest in its topmost branches was of such a large, uncommon shape that he had no doubt that it was Shumal's eyrie. Carrying Baal's magical lance slung over his shoulder, he climbed with reckless haste, reaching the nest before the sun dipped below the horizon. But the clear skies were empty around the entire circuit of the compass. Where was the fearsome bird? Daniel had not considered the possibility that Shumal would be occupied elsewhere. There were 5 eggs in the nest. Each one of them was as big as a wine jug. As he examined them, he noticed a spreading crack in one of the shells. A glistening beak was starting to emerge. The egg was hatching. Soon the blind, slimy head of a fledgling eagle had emerged and was screaming for its mother. Yes, Daniel said as he unslung his weapon and made himself ready for battle. Call your mother! Before the last rays of the sun had died, Shumal came winging back over the sea, following the faint sound of her newborn's cry, for a mother's instinct overcomes even the command of a goddess. And as she swooped down to protect her young, she felt her feathered breast struck, her bones shattered, and her great heart burst. The meteor-headed Yagrish had found its mark. Shumal tumbled like a broken tree limb to crash on the rocks below. By the time Daniel had climbed down to reach her, the mother of eagles was dead. He cut open her gizzard and found the few nearly digested fragments of human bone that were the last remnants of Prince Akkad. And yet they were enough to bury, and the border of Bashan was less than a league to the south. He would inter the prince deep under the cairn of stones before midnight, and a proper tomb could be erected later. 2 of Yat-Pon's warriors roughly escorted Pugat into their master's tent. The warlord had been expecting Queen Danate, but when Pugat pulled back
the hood of her mantle, Yat-Pon exploded in rage. What trick is this? The queen sends a wench in her stead? Cut this whore in pieces and feed her to the dogs.
Pugat drew herself up proudly. I am the only daughter of King Daniel of Bashan, she said. This mollified Yat-Pon somewhat. He motioned his guards to release her.
I am a virgin, I suppose.
Most assuredly, my lord, she said. Well, why did your mother not keep her word? Well, her monthly curse came upon her suddenly, and she thought I would give you more pleasure. Yat-Pon poured a large measure of wine into his goblet. It was a sensible answer. An unclean woman would have displeased him. And this way, he got to have them both. for he would surely mount the queen in a few days hence. And with a wave of his hand, the warlord dismissed his guardsmen. He grabbed Phukot's gown by the bodice and ripped that clinging linen from her body. She stood naked before him with her chin held high. "Do with me as you will, my lord," she said. Yatban voiced a harsh laugh. "Oh, I will," he said, seizing her by the hair and forcing her face down over a saddle. "I will indeed." And there we're going to have to stop until our next episode, which will be 2 weeks from now, because unfortunately for the sequence of the story, I have to be off. I have to be off to Phoenix to a reunion of one of the world's, if not the world's largest secret society. So anyway, I will be back in 2 weeks, and we will finish up Prince of Kot, and we'll take calls, and we will have a hermetic hour again, and I'll see you all in 2 weeks' time.